Hey guys, you're listening to the most captivating podcast in iTunes. That's right, the Elite Man Podcast, where we turn average men into elite men every day. We interview the very best experts from the lifestyle, health, fitness, social, and even entrepreneurial worlds. And with their help, we give you some of the best advice on the planet. Subscribe now if you haven't already and enjoy the show. And oh yeah, if you really enjoy it, leave us a review.
On today's episode, episode number 206, entitled How to Win the Internal War Against Yourself, I chat with Eric Zimmer. Eric Zimmer is a behavioral change coach and a podcast host, and in today's episode, Eric talks about how he overcame a severe drug and alcohol addiction and how he was able to pull himself up after hitting rock bottom in his early 20s. He covers the darkest times of his life, including homelessness, being arrested, and weighing 50 pounds lighter than his normal weight because of drug abuse. Eric talks about what he did to turn his life around and how he dealt with his internal demons and was able to overcome them. If you're wondering how to win the war that resides within you and within all of us, and how to overcome life's darkest days, check this episode out now. You are going to love it. If you have not checked out our YouTube videos, go to elitemanmagazine.com/YouTube right now. Our YouTube channel just launched a couple weeks back, and already the feedback has been phenomenal. Equal parts entertaining and informative, our YouTube videos will make you laugh, cry, smile, think, question, and celebrate the fantastic knowledge being bestowed to all. Every week, we cover all your favorite Elite Man topics and break down everything you need to know to be the best man you can be. Go to elitemanmagazine.com/YouTube right now or click the link in the show notes to start viewing our videos. Make sure you like and leave a comment with your thoughts on each video too. It helps us out a ton and helps spread the message and grow our channel. Also, subscribe to our channel right now if you haven't yet. I promise you're going to love these videos and the ones we'll be releasing in the upcoming future. Subscribe to our channel and watch now at elitemanmagazine.com/YouTube or click the link in the show notes. In today's age, it can be hard to find the time to sit down and learn more. It's not easy when the likes of social media can be so addictive and time-consuming, so you may think you don't have the time to read a book or to develop yourself, but you do. There is an app I highly recommend, and it's called Blinkist. Blinkist is the only app that takes the best key takeaways, the need-to-know information from thousands of nonfiction books, and condenses them down into just 15 minutes so you can read or listen to them fast. Blinkist is made for busy people like you who want to get the main points of the books quickly without having to read the entire book. With an audio feature, Blinkist makes it so easy to finish 4 books a day while you are on the go. 8 million people are using Blinkist right now, and it has a massive and growing library. From self-help to business to health to history books, it's got it all. I like Blinkist because in less than 15 minutes, I feel like I can fast track my path to a more intelligent and informed me. I use Blinkist most mornings when I'm making my morning smoothie. In fact, this past week alone, I've gone through The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People by Stephen Covey, The Power of Habits by Charles Duhigg, and Start With Why by Simon Sinek. I love being able to breeze through some of these incredible books and still get the main takeaways from them. It's actually really, really cool. Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/elite to start your free 7-day trial. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/elite to start your 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/elite. All right, guys, we're live. It's Justin Stenstrom from EliteManMagazine.com, and my guest today is Eric Zimmer from the One You Feed podcast. Eric, thanks so much for coming on the show, man.
Thanks for having me on, Justin. It's a pleasure to talk with you again.
Yeah, I was on your show, I think, 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago now, pretty long time ago, but we had a blast way back whenever we did have the call, and it was a pleasure being on your show, so I'm happy to return the favor. I know you're an interesting dude. You have a lot of experiences in the past, a lot of struggle that you've overcome, so I want to pick your brain on some of the things that you did to overcome that. Can you take just a minute or so and just kind of, for those who aren't as familiar with Eric Zimmer, fill in the background of what you do now and sort of a little bit of the struggles that I've alluded to.
Sure. Well, now I'm the host of the One You Feed podcast, as you mentioned. I'm also a behavior coach. You know, I help people to make whatever change in their life they want to make. So that's kind of what I do now. It's been a long journey getting here. Before this, I ran a solar energy company and did multiple software startup companies. But even before all that, I was a homeless heroin addict at the age of 24, and I was in a lot of trouble. I was looking to go to jail for a long time. I was really, really sick with hepatitis C. So I was in bad shape. And so the getting over that really launched me on this, you know, that's an overused word, but journey of really getting better, and finally landed me today where I'm really happy. I think I can bring all my different skills together in a really great way.
Yeah, and I mentioned to you this a moment ago before we actually started recording, but I love the theme of your podcast and the website as well that you have, theoneyoufeed.net, and it's basically the parable of the tale of two wolves. And I want to just read through it, but before I go through it and describe the parable, where did you first find, I'm just curious myself, where did you first come across this parable? It's really cool.
Yeah, I first heard it in recovery. So early on in recovery from, from a heroin addiction, I heard it, and, you know, it really spoke to me strongly. The great thing about certain parables or certain stories is they go past just the mind, and they kind of hit you at a deeper level. You know, a few words says a lot, and this one did that for me for sure.
Yeah, and it is. It's pretty brief. It's pretty concise, but it's very profound. There's a lot to it, and it just goes to show you, you know, how applicable it is to so many different lives. And all right, so I want to just go over it, and then I want to ask you, because you asked me this a couple of years back when I was on your show, what the parable means to you. So the parable is called The Tale of Two Wolves, and it goes like this. A grandfather is talking with his grandson, and he says there are two wolves inside of us which are always at battle. One wolf is a good wolf, which represents things like kindness, bravery, and love. The other is a bad wolf, which represents things like greed, hatred, and fear. The grandson stops and thinks about it for a second, then he looks up to his grandfather and says, "Grandfather, which one wins?" The grandfather quietly replies, "The one you feed." And again, that's the title of your podcast, and basically the theme of what you do and the work that you do. What does that mean to you exactly, and how did you use that parable specifically in your own life, and especially when you were overcoming the addiction and the heroin addiction and that struggle?
Well, I think on one level, we all understand it immediately when we hear it. It says that the choices we make in life matter. You know, that we all have these two forces inside of us, or you could say we all have the seeds of positive and negative actions or positive and negative thoughts. We've got both that inside of us. And what we get in our life is a result of which of those things we feed. Obviously, at the time, it spoke very clear to me because my bad wolf was eating me alive. Like I said, I was in really, really bad shape at that point. So the parable spoke to me so strongly. And in recovery from addiction, there are a series of real clear actions that you can take. And I think it's really true about changing anything. Making changes in our life are about the actions we take. And so for me in early recovery, I had a very clear sort of list of like, do these things. And so for me, that parable really spoke to me about, okay, let me really focus on doing those things. And if I do those things, I feel like I'm going to recover. I'm going to get better. The other thing I like about the parable is it doesn't really talk about doing anything to your bad wolf. It doesn't talk about starving him or throwing him in a cage. It just simply says, look, let's put more focus on the positive parts of our life. Let's put more focus there. Not that these other parts of our lives, these dark parts of our lives, don't have a place. They have a meaning. Sometimes they have a purpose. Sometimes that bad wolf is telling us things. So it's not about caging the bad wolf or starving it, but it's about giving more attention to the good wolf.
Yeah, I really do love that parable, and I think to you it did a lot in your life. What were some of the reasons, do you think, looking back now, that you actually ended up being addicted to heroin and had those problems way back when in your early 20s? What were some of the things that led to that?
Well, you know, recovery from addiction is one of those things that, at least initially knowing why, is not often a lot of help. What I think is that all addiction, and addiction I think is on a continuum from, you know, not addicted at all to, you know, stone cold addict. I think there's a continuum of any behavior in there. But I think in my case, it boils down to, and in all cases, some inability to accept the feelings that I have. Whatever is happening inside of me, I don't like, and I don't have any tolerance to be able to stay with it. And so I have to change it. And so an addiction is a nasty cycle because you don't really feel good necessarily about yourself or about how you're feeling. So then you engage in the addictive behavior, which makes you feel better for a little bit, but then you come out of it and everything is worse than it was before you started. And so now you feel worse than you did. So you engage in it again. And it's just a nasty downward spiral. Yeah. So, you know, the reasons are, you know, it's hard to tag the reasons, but I think for whatever combination of reasons, I didn't feel comfortable in my own skin. And so when I found substances that made me feel way, way better, I latched onto them, and they were, you know, the thing about addiction is it always works for a while. People wouldn't go so far down if that substance wasn't giving them something. We had a guest on the show, Gabor Mate, who is a, you know, very well known in the addiction space. And, you know, he says, you know, don't ask why the addiction, ask why the pain. And so, you know, all this does come from some sort of underlying pain, you know, trauma in childhood, neglect in childhood. Those are all parts of it, but that's not the only thing. But my experience was really initially the most important thing was what was I doing to get better? Not so much what made me that way to start with. Now, as recovery goes on, I think getting deeper into those things is important and needs to be done, but it's not necessarily critical right at the very beginning, and sometimes can be a distraction.
So what were some of the first steps that you did? What were some of the actionable things that you did to pull yourself out of that hole?
Well, you know, I recovered in a 12-step program, and there's lots of things I love about 12-step programs and some things I don't love, but that was what worked for me. And in a 12-step program, it was really about you know, going to meetings regularly, and that had the effect of really putting me in a community of people who were just like me, people who could say, "Yep, I've been right where you are, and now I'm over here, and I'm doing better. Just, you know, follow me," right? And that's a really important part of, I think, recovery from addiction is finding some people that you see that are a little further along that journey than you are, who can guide you along the way. So going to meetings was a big part of it. Developing a spiritual life was part of it. Learning how simply to let cravings pass, you know, developing skills that say, okay, I really, really want to use. Okay, but you know what? I'm not going to right now. I mean, one of the things that AA is famous for is that phrase, one day at a time. But it also can be 1 minute at a time, 1 hour at a time. You know, don't use for the next hour. Okay, for the next hour, I'm not going to. You know, so learning skills to deal with cravings was part of it. And then eventually starting to get into some of the underlying psychological forces. And then I think the other thing that AA does a really good job of doing, and sometimes too good of a job if you stay stuck in it too long, but to get you to really take accountability for that, the things that are happening in your life are, they're decisions you're making. Your addiction is a decision that you are making. Now, it may be very, very, very difficult not to make it, but ultimately, you know, you have to, there's a basic starting point of responsibility that says, okay, whatever got me to this point may not be my fault, but I'm the only one now that can make this better. You know, I need help. I need lots of other people, but I've got to stand in a place here that says, okay, you know what, if I keep throwing the fault for everything that happened out there on everyone else, that's not going to work. I have to stop and say, okay, let me own the fact that my recovery is really up to me to do.
Yeah, I think it always starts with you in anything in this area, than anything in this kind of field of major life change or breakthrough in life and coming across the other side. It always starts with you, and you taking responsibility is the first thing. So many people, I think, make excuses, especially in like business too, you know, entrepreneurial type things and, you know, failures and different things in life like that. It always starts with taking responsibility as the first step and owning the fact that you have control over the outcomes in your life. Of course, things pop up and you get knocked down. Of course, you know, it's just a natural part of life. But at the end of the day, it's how you respond to those things and how you get back up to whether or not you're going to succeed or get past something that puts you down.
Right. Ultimately, yes. And often it's, interesting, because I think a lot of times with addiction, you could say it's not your fault. What happened to you turned you into an addict, but it is your responsibility to get better. Nobody else is going to do it for you if you don't do it yourself. And again, when I say yourself, I do think that a community of people that you find somewhere, somehow, is so important. But ultimately, yeah, the buck kind of ends with you.
Yeah. So take us through the final day of you using heroin, or the first day that you decided that you were going to quit heroin. Is there some kind of story related there? Did you hit like rock bottom and decide that, this is going to be it and that you have to change, or else you're going to either die or just end up in jail?
Well, sort of. I mean, I had been to treatment a few times before, so this wasn't my first time at trying to get better. But I had, like I said, I was homeless, except I was living in the back of a van that was from a restaurant that I worked at. And one day I got arrested at that restaurant for grand theft and forgery and a series of other things. And I lost the job. I lost the van. I lost everything. And so I went into detox simply because I was like, I'm going to be really sick and I don't know what to do. I don't have that job was where I got a lot of the money. Everything kind of fell apart. And I was like, all right, I need a place to just have a few days of not being really, really sick from drugs. And so I went in there and they said, you really need to go to our 28-day program. And my original thought was no. And I said that. I said, I don't think that's really a great idea. And I went back to my room and I had kind of what people often refer to as a moment of clarity. And that moment of clarity really was, if I go back out there, I'm probably going to die. And if I don't die, I'm going to go to jail for a long time. And I just had that moment of clarity that showed me just how really dire things were, how bad they were. And so I made an agreement to go into the 28-day treatment program at that point. This was right at Christmas, and I'd gone into the detox. I said, I need to go home for a couple days at Christmas. So they said, fine. So I went home for a couple days at Christmas. My last actual use of heroin was Christmas Eve night. I had gone to a family party, and my grandparents had given me $50. And, that was just the right amount to get what I needed. And I remember this night so clearly. I was in my mom's car. I snuck it out of the garage in the middle of the night, and I was crying because I didn't want to go do it. And it just felt like I was propelled by some other force to go do this, to go get high. I remember just that awfulness of that. And so I went and I got high, but that was the last time that I ever used heroin. And the day after Christmas, I went back into the 28-day treatment program, and I just sort of threw myself into recovery. I just became willing to do whatever people suggested would help me to get better. I think the times I'd gone to treatment before, I would do a little bit of what they said. I'd be like, well, I'll do this, but I don't really like that idea, and I don't like that idea. This time I was just like, okay, whatever you say to do, I'm going to try it. And so that led to the last time I used heroin. Now, I did stay sober about 8 or 9 years, and then I did drink again for a couple years. And then I've now been back completely sober for another 13 years, I think.
What is, that's incredibly interesting. What is actually more, what was tougher for you to quit, the alcohol or the heroin? And, my natural instinct is to say that heroin seems like it's a lot harder, but then you look at, the numbers of people that are actually alcoholics that far outweigh the heroin addicts, I think. I don't know. It's just a complete guess. But what was tougher for you?
Well, I think those questions always miss a central point. And these questions about which substance is more addictive than another substance, I think they miss the point because they're focused only on how addictive that substance is and how strong the cravings might be right as you're getting sober. But after a period of time on any of those substances, if you get a period of time, those cravings, the physiological component of them, that part that's being caused by the drug, goes away. And so it's really a question of remaining sober longer term. And so in my case, it was way harder to stop drinking when I stopped drinking the second time. But a lot of that was circumstantial. I had just gotten promoted to the best job I'd ever had. I had a family. I had a nice house. You know, on the outside, I was doing really well. But on the inside, I knew that I was every bit as addicted to alcohol as I was to heroin. And I had not had bad consequences yet, but I knew they would come. So the second time for me was harder because it was a little bit more of an intellectual exercise. I had to sort of look at it and go, do I really need to take this to a bottom? Do I really need to be in a car wreck that hurts myself or my son or someone else because I've been drinking and driving? Do I need to lose a job? Do I really have to do that? And that was a little bit more an intellectual exercise, which made it a little bit harder. The first time, I was so thoroughly beaten that, I was just ready to do whatever because I just was so thoroughly beaten. The second time was a little bit different because I had not been as thoroughly defeated by alcohol, but I had enough knowledge of what addiction was to know that I was in no way different between the heroin and the alcohol. It's just that, you know, alcohol is easy to support. I don't have to do illegal things to get it. I don't need to have $500 a day to get high. I don't have to, you know, go, purchase drugs illegally. I can walk into the store for, you know, a small amount of money and get drunk. But my internal state was every bit as lost and as addicted. So for me, the second time was harder, but that was really circumstantial, not so much substance related. And I think that's the case with a lot of us. We can talk about how addictive these things are, and they are addictive, but ultimately the addiction is more psychological than it is physiological. In the beginning, it's very much physiological. Like coming off alcohol or heroin or any of those things, you need help doing that. But after a certain point, that stuff works it way out of your system, and then it's all psychological.
Yeah, so I guess to me it definitely seems like the heroin is more physiologically addictive and the alcohol is more like emotionally addictive in the long term. But I guess I asked the question because I've never been addicted to either one of those. But I've known friends and people who have been addicted to either heroin or opioids, and then I've known a lot of friends that have been addicted to alcohol, but they don't even like think they're addicted to alcohol. Heroin can be a lot more damaging to you physically. It can basically, you know, like in your case, you lost like 50 pounds, I read, and you know, were a junkie, homeless, living on the street. Whereas like alcoholics, they can be a lot of the time, they can be a lot more functional and they can basically look like normal people. And, you know, that other than their addiction to alcohol, there really isn't anything physiologically that you notice out of the norm in, say, an alcoholic as opposed to like a heroin addict. And, you know, in the town, the city I live in, there's plenty of people here that are addicted to opioids and heroin. And immediately you can tell that they're addicted to something like that just by looking at them.
Yeah. I mean, alcohol does take a tremendous toll on your body over time. And at a certain point, you know, alcohol will kill you. Withdrawal from alcohol, if you've drank a lot of it for a long time, is very, very dangerous. You know, alcohol withdrawal can kill you. Heroin withdrawal can be pretty rough, but usually doesn't kill you. Alcohol is a depressant long term. I mean, and so, but yes, in general, it's a lot easier to sustain a life of being an alcoholic than it is a hard drug addict. And a lot of that is simply due to availability and the laws and all of that. But alcohol is doing a lot to your system. It's just not readily apparent to us. It takes longer, but it is long term, it is every bit as destructive. Yeah. If you do it in great quantities for a long time. I mean, you know, cirrhosis of the liver. I mean, lots of people die from alcoholism and health complications related to it.
Yeah. And, you know, like all the studies and stuff coming out on the safety of, like, say, marijuana or cannabis use as opposed to alcohol. Like, alcohol kills way more people every year than marijuana ever did. But, you know,
there's no doubt about that. I mean,
a different topic.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
But so, I mean, this is fascinating, man. So you're pulling yourself out of the hole. You're going through the 12 steps. What is the biggest thing that you did probably out of those 12 steps, or maybe something else that you've kind of found on your own along the course of the way that you think was like the turning point for you? What did you do that after that point, or maybe like the biggest thing that you did to really turn things around and start picking yourself back up?
Well, I don't know that there was a, outside of the moment where I decided like, okay, I'm going to go into long-term treatment. Outside of that moment, you know, I don't know that there's one moment that stands out as like the moment. You know, every time there's a craving to use, you know, the withstanding that is a choice point. There's thousands of choice points in recovery, just like there are in 1,000 choice points in building a business or getting in good shape or eating well or building a meditation practice. You're presented with these points over and over and over again where you choose what direction. And so for me, it's hard for me to say like I did this one thing. What I did was I took the right action over and over and over and over again, and I became a very different person. And I think that's the way change happens. But if there was one sort of fundamental thing that really sort of made a huge difference for me, it was recognizing that I can survive a negative feeling. I can feel like crap and I don't have to do something about it. It's just a negative emotion. It's not going to kill me. I don't have to respond to it. And that's what a lot of addiction is. I feel like crap, I respond. I feel like crap, I respond, right? I don't like the way I feel, so I change it. I don't like the way I feel, so I change it. And some of a big part of recovery is being able just to go, okay, I don't like the way I feel. That's all right. I don't like it, but it's not going to kill me. I don't have to do something. And, you know, that phrase is often easily summed up, or that idea is easily summed up by the phrase, emotions are not emergencies, right? And so for me, that was a big fundamental thing that really underlies most of the change that has happened in my life, is that recognition. Okay, an emotion is not an emergency. I don't have to do something with this. And that applies to not taking a drink, not taking a drug. That applies to, I'm really angry. Well, it doesn't mean I have to lash out at everybody around me. Or, you know, I feel lonely. So that doesn't mean I have to rush out and find someone to hook up with tonight. It means that we can start to sit a little bit with the negative feelings we have and recognize that's just all they are. They're not going to kill us.
Yeah, when you talk about just sitting in basically observing the feelings as opposed to reacting to them, what are you doing there? Are you just basically like kind of meditating and an introspection kind of thing, where you're just like sitting down and thinking of these bad feelings when they pop up, and then you kind of go back to normal everyday life and everyday thinking? Like, so you're taking a break kind of from everyday life, or is it just like, or is there a different type of routine or practice to it?
Well, you know, I think meditation practice is a strong practice because it allows us to start to really see what our mind does. So as a practice, that's really helpful. But a lot of times when, you know, this is just living life, you get an emotion. A lot of us get an emotion or a thought and we just react to it. You know, it's like stimulus and response. There's no space there. Here's the stimulus. Here's what my response is. And this is really just about getting a little space in between those two. You know, this is why, you know, one day at a time, 1 hour at a time, 1 minute at a time. Okay, I really feel depressed and anxious and I want to use. Okay, I'm not going to. I'm going to sit here for an hour. Doesn't mean I have to sit there and stare directly at the thoughts. You can do that. But sometimes it's just do something else. But allow them to go. Allow them to sort of realize that thoughts and emotions aren't permanent. They come and then they go. They come and then they go. And just, you know, staying true to yourself in the midst of that. You know, it's, you know, you could take this for alcohol and drugs, you could take it for eating. You know, I feel depressed, so I grab a candy bar. Now, some of it is first recognizing that that's even the mechanism that's happening. A lot of times, all we recognize is I grabbed a candy bar. But if we deconstruct the process or we back up a little bit, we go, oh, well, I grab the candy bar often because I'm feeling this way. I'm feeling this thing. So, okay, what happens if I don't grab the candy bar? Or what else could I do instead of grabbing the candy bar? So meditation helps with this, but a lot of it is just starting to recognize, all right, what's happening inside me emotionally, and then what is a healthier reaction to that than what the action I'm used to taking is.
Yeah. Did you have a lot of anxiety and depression at this time surrounding the recovery from alcohol and heroin use?
Well, what I realized into recovery a few years was that I suffered from clinical depression. Yes, I did have that happening. I mean, I don't know about anxiety beyond the probably perfectly healthy anxiety, which was if I go out there, really bad things are going to happen. You know, if I use again and fail this drug test, I'm going to go to jail for 30 years. And I don't even know I'd call that anxiety so much as just common, you know, like basic sense.
Yeah.
but yes, I mean, you know, then, you know, for me, after the initial recovery came, you know, dealing with depression, because that was, you know, I recognized that was a lot of what drove me to use. You know, depression in my case is very much a deadening sensation. When I'm depressed, I don't feel much of anything. It's not like I'm incredibly sad. I just feel really empty. And, you know, like nothing makes me interested in life. Nothing makes me happy. You know, the things that normally I enjoy, I don't enjoy. And so for me, drugs and alcohol, when I would take them, they sort of turned me on. They sort of, you know, there's a famous line from an old movie called Days of Wine and Roses. And it's about two alcoholics. And at one point, the woman says something like, you know, day to day, my life is like it's black and white. But when I drink, it's like all the color gets turned on. So that was a lot of what alcohol and drugs did for me. They sort of dealt with that depression. I mean, I still jokingly say two drinks is the best antidepressant I've ever found. The problem is that it's never two drinks. You know, it's two and then it's 10, then it's 20, and then it's, you know, so it doesn't work. It's not a workable solution. But two drinks will, you know, used to inevitably make me feel better. So I've just had to learn to do that different ways. But yeah, dealing with depression has been something I have, you know, dealt with really all my adult life.
So how have you gotten over that? Because that seems to me like a key component to being addicted is having that. And you know, I'm even thinking physiologically here, like it makes a lot of sense that, you know, they've done recent studies in the past couple decades, especially have shown the dopamine link to addiction. And it's that dopamine hit that keeps you, like you just said, I mean, two drinks of alcohol will put you in the state to be happy again. It's literally the dopamine in your brain that's going off and reacting to that. And then of course the heroin, which I think is even stronger for, like, again, we said physiologically, probably stronger than alcohol. You get probably even a stronger dopamine response in your brain. And so that's what kind of triggers you to keep wanting to do it after. And even though you know it's bad for you, it's like, this is the only way you can be happy is when you do that. And so, like, how have you gone without doing that and still being happy and obviously later in your life being more successful with, you know, financially and doing the business. And then of course the One You Feed podcast, all this other stuff you're doing now.
Yep. I mean, you make a really good point that often addiction coexists with mental illness of some sort. And by mental illness, I mean just even run-of-the-mill depression, anxiety, et cetera, right? And so in my case, I drank because it sort of woke me up, right? But a lot of people drink or do drugs because it settles them down. They're just so wired, so anxious, so afraid. They may have so much trauma that it turns that down. So it does different things for different people. It's a variation on, I can't stand the way I feel, so I'm going to change it. So I do think it's really important to look at, you know, are there other things going on besides just alcoholism or addiction, and how can you treat it? I love AA and 12-step programs, but one of the things it doesn't do, I don't think, is treat alcoholism or addiction very holistically. It very much focuses on, you know, the 12 steps and a spiritual relationship and connection, but it doesn't really do much about a lot of other things that I think are important, which might be treating your mental illness, about exercising, about eating well, about lots and lots of other things. So I do think it's important to look at these other factors. And for me, you know, I've treated depression over the years a variety of ways. I've treated it chemically, and I was on antidepressants a long time. And I think they worked for me they really did help. And so that can be part of the solution. What I found for me was that just antidepressants really wasn't enough. I needed kind of everything else. I often joke, like, I just throw the kitchen sink at my depression, right? Like, I have done everything that I can think of that helps. And so for me, you know, medicine was part of that at one point. Exercise is a huge one for me. It really makes a big, big difference in managing my depression. More and more, I've realized how important diet is. You know, how when I eat well, I feel better. Connecting with other people, friendships, and being able to talk about what's happening to you. Finding things that you enjoy. I mean, there's so many different ways. But my experience was that all this stuff needs to be treated sort of in a much more holistic, thorough way, that we need as many tools as we can to help with addiction or depression or anxiety. And so for me, it's been kind of all of that stuff.
Yeah. And yeah, man, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. And I think you've done the right thing and touched on the fact that you're touching on so many different great things. And, you know, the exercise, the diet, the purpose, the connection to others, being like connected and having a sense of community. I would add to that too, even sleep as well. I mean, obviously,
yes.
I'm sure you've optimized that. Meditation, as we talked about. And then even supplementation, which is something that oftentimes people overlook, but simple things like taking minerals like magnesium or even a multivitamin or optimizing your vitamin D. They talk about seasonal depression, and it's
yep.
basically because people stay indoors, they don't get enough vitamin D. And that's, you know, one simple little thing like that, correcting your vitamin D and optimizing to say like, you know, 5,000 IUs a day or something like that, as opposed to like, you know, probably the 50 IUs you're getting in your diet.
Yep.
You know, there's little simple corrections and just or optimizations in supplements and especially in your diet can dramatically change someone's depression. And then, you know, this is basically the underlying cause, I think, to the reason most people have addiction. It's either one of the two. It's either the depression or the anxiety or some type of variance of the two. Like you said, one's either like you're restless or anxious or stressed out, so you got to calm down. Or in your case, which I think is often overlooked too, because you don't typically think drugs will, like heroin or something, would pick you up. But if it's doing that to the brain, like the dopamine release, I think it absolutely can. But again, in your case, like it actually lifts you up. So, you know, I think it's important to, like in the beginning, you said this, you know, it makes sense to me too. Like you want to just focus on getting better. But at that point, once you get back to baseline, you want to figure out why you needed to get better in the first place, why you even had this problem in the first place, right?
Agreed. Yeah. I mean, I think there is, like I say, I just recommend doing everything that you can think of to do. Try. You know, addiction, recovery from addiction, recovery from depression often isn't like, well, I just decided today would be the day and now everything's better, right? It's like, well, I tried this, it got a little bit better, but then I fell back. But then I tried this and, you know, it's just everybody's a little bit different. So, you know, there's lots of basic guidelines out there of things that are good to do. Find some that work for you and just keep doing them and keep experimenting and keep trying, because, you know, everybody's different. Depressions are different. There's not one kind of depression. There's not one kind of anxiety. But I do agree with you that underlying mechanism of emotional distress drives an awful lot of addiction. And whether that, you know, a lot of times, you know, trauma is a big one. People have suffered trauma. That is it's why, you know, it's been shown over and over and over that people who had what they call adverse childhood experiences, from trauma to neglect to just, I mean, there's a lot of them. Those people are, you know, 3, 5, 10 times more likely to become addicts. So there's so many different factors, and you really kind of have to work on all of it. But just starting is the place, and finding some sort of program. Doesn't have to be a 12-step program, but some sort of program that gives you the guidance and some structure to follow. Like, you know, it's very difficult to figure all this out, so it's really helpful to have guides.
Yeah, no, it definitely is. Do you still have cravings? Do you still have days where you just want to go out and have a couple beers? Or even, I think worse than that, do you still have those days or those moments in days where it's like, you know, I wish I had a hit of heroin right now, or I wish, you know, like, I don't know if it's as stupid as that sounding, but, you know, do you have those types of things?
I haven't had a desire for heroin for a long time. Alcohol and marijuana sometimes, but not too much. Usually what I notice is that if I start to notice myself thinking about those things or noticing them. So for example, if I'm out to dinner and I sort of start noticing like, oh, look at, you know, all those people are having a beer, or look at all those glasses of wine over there. Look at all that booze behind the counter. And I feel it tug at me just a little bit. I kind of start to go, okay, I'm off. Something's not quite right with me. So yes, I have it, but not what I would call a craving. You know, it's not been hard in a long time for me to resist. I haven't had to, like, it's mostly like I just feel that little tug and I go, huh, all right, let me make sure I'm taking care of myself. But the great thing about, you know, recovery for a lot of people, and actually for most people I know who get some significant amount of time, it's not like you're fighting it all the time. You hit a point where it's not like that. You have to sort of keep yourself in what I'd call a good condition. But when I'm in a good condition, no, I don't have cravings. I don't struggle with it.
Okay. No, that makes sense. I've heard over the years with different people I've talked to and friends I know that they've replaced their addiction with something else that they've, like a healthy addiction, like for instance, exercising or eating healthier or doing some type of activity where they go out and, you know, spend X amount of time each week doing to get their mind away from the actual feelings or thoughts of doing the drugs. Is that something you've done too?
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, I think, you know, it's interesting to look at, like, what is an addiction, right? Because I hear people say that, like, well, you know, you've just replaced one addiction with another. A lot of people say that about 12-step programs. You've just replaced drinking with going to meetings. Well, that may be true, but in my case, that was a hell of an improvement, right?
Yeah.
You know, same thing with exercise. Is your exercise an addiction, or is it just you taking care of yourself? I mean, an addiction implies that you're starting to have some sort of negative consequence from it and you continue to do it anyway. But sure, replacement is part of it. You know, it's why I think 12-step programs, one of the reasons I think they work is that suddenly you have a social life that replaces the social life you got from drinking. If you suddenly, that just vaporizes, all right, I can't be around any of those people anymore. Now I'm lonely all the time. You need to replace that. You know, and so whether these are, you know, trading one addiction for another, I think sort of depends on how far you take those things. But I think that doing things that you enjoy in life and that make you feel good, that's not always an addiction, right? It's just how far do you take it? And I think that finding things you like to do in life and feeling good and doing those regularly is living a good life.
Yeah. How have you been able to apply these skills that you learned through your own struggles in life and overcoming addiction to helping other people change just everyday things in their behaviors, you know, being a behavioral coach that you are now, when people come to you with different problems of everyday life, how have you used some of these lessons that you've learned to help them out?
Well, I mean, I think there are so many different reasons that we either do things we don't want to do. So are we trying to get rid of a bad habit or addiction, or are we trying to build a good habit? You know, so many principles are same, and the underlying principle with a lot of it is, okay, I don't like how I feel, so I change it. So procrastination is a variation on this. I don't like how I feel when I look at sitting down to do this task, or right as I sit down to do it, I feel awful. So I give in to feel good. It's not that different than I give in, I say tomorrow I'll do it, is not that different than saying, oh, well, I'll take a drink to feel different. These things are all very related. So there's that underlying component, learning to sort of, okay, I don't like how I feel. I don't like what this is bringing up in me. I'm still going to take the right action, learning to do that. And then I think, again, a lot of it, as I said earlier, there's so many different things that you can do that having a guide is so important. So a lot of habit change and behavior change, there's lots of science that shows knowing exactly what to do, When you're going to do it, where you're going to do it, like lots of specificity helps. So we really sort of look at both those things. We look at, all right, is our plan clear? Is it achievable? Is it doable? Am I taking on too much? But making sure we've got a really clear plan that works in your life. It's not enough to just be like, here's what everybody should do. You got to look at your life. What are the constraints, responsibilities that you have in life? What's your schedule, your structure? So there's that. And then there's the learning to deal with the moment. Inevitably, all this inevitably comes up to a moment where you either say, I'm not going to do that, like a drug or eating or whatever. I'm not going to do that. Or a moment which is the opposite of that, which is I am going to do that. The moment a choice comes, I know that exercising is good for me. I know that when I do it, I feel better. It helps my depression. The moment comes, do you do it or do you sit on the couch? And so there's these choice points over and over, and there's things that we can do to make those choice points easier and clearer and more achievable.
Yeah. So when you have those choice points pop up, is it just a conversation that you have in your head and then you're on the path of doing this so many times over and over again that as you do it more and more, it becomes easier to make the right choice?
Yes, absolutely. Some of it is, you know, the idea that in 21 days we build a habit has largely been debunked. It doesn't really work that way. But yes, we do build habits. Things become easier to do. You get distance from doing something, it becomes easier not to do it. Yeah, and then there's just lots of little tricks. Like one of my favorite ones, and it's so silly, but it really works, is to sort of trick yourself into getting started. So this happens to me more often than I would like, but it's like, all right, I need to go get to the gym because I know, you know, that's, I made a commitment to myself. I'm going to do it. It helps. I mean, I know 100% exercise is great for me, but yet here I am. I don't feel like it. You know, so a lot of times if the resistance is really strong, I say something like, all right, just get your gym clothes on. You know, that's all you got to do. And then from there, it's like, well, just get to the gym. You don't have to do anything once you get there. So sometimes these little sort of tricking ourselves into getting started is half the battle. You want to clean your house and it's like, oh, it seems overwhelming. I'll set a timer and clean for 5 minutes. More often than not, way more often than not, like upwards of 90%, if I do that, if I set the timer or I get myself to the gym, I end up doing the behavior I'm going to do. So a lot of times it's just getting in motion. You know, that old sort of physics lesson of a body in motion stays in motion and a body at rest stays at rest. A lot of times we just got to find some way to get moving, just get past that point of inertia. And that can make a big difference. So there's lots of little things like that that we can do. But yes, ideally, you do this stuff, you start to get the positive results from it. It becomes easier and easier to do. It becomes habituated, and it just sort of becomes part of who you are.
Yeah. No, I love that little technique too. And I can think of so many instances in my life where I've applied that and still apply it today, whether it's doing chores or washing the dishes or doing another couple reps at the gym. I mean, just, you know, tricking yourself like that is it sounds like it's kind of like you would know better to like to keep doing it. But it, I mean, it works. You trick your mind into doing it, and it's a very effective way to do it.
Yeah, I'm almost embarrassed by how often I do it. And there's one thing that mystifies me, and having people on the show and interviewing 250 people, it's still the greatest mystery to me, which is this. Every single time in my life I have exercised, afterwards I have said, I am really glad I did that. Like every time, no exception, thousands of times. You would think with that sort of 100% yes rate that I would just jump right into it every time. And yet sometimes it's still a struggle and I just don't understand it.
Yeah.
But I know how to work through it. And so I guess that's the important part.
Yeah, no, it definitely is. Real quick, man, for those who haven't made it a habit yet to make the right choice and to keep doing the same right thing over and over again so it gets easier and easier. Say they're on the first step. Maybe they're listening to the show and they are addicted to something out there, or maybe they're ready to take a big step in their life and make that first change that they have to make. What do you recommend to them?
Well, I mean, I think there's lots of different things. If you're trying to make a behavior change of the positive sort, I want to start exercising, I want to start meditating, you know, the place to just try is see if you're already doing this or not is come up with a very clear plan. Decide exactly what you're going to do, where you're going to do it, when you're going to do it, and make it easy to do to start. You know, don't make it, if you haven't worked out in 6 months, don't make it go to the gym for 2 hours, right? Make it go into the gym for 10 minutes. Like, start small and build. But having a really specific plan is really, really important. It's called implementation instructions, and there's been a lot of studies that show we're 5 or 6 times more likely to do something if we've done that. You know, if you're dealing with an addiction, it's probably useful that you find some help somewhere, whether that there's lots of online resources. You can find a 12-step meeting nearly anywhere, anytime. But it's often useful to get some actual structured, guided help. And with the trying to create a new behavior, if you keep trying and it's not working, same thing. You know, try and find somebody who can help you change that behavior. But often it's about getting really specific, making it small enough, and then just, you know, building consistency day after day.
Eric, it's been an awesome interview, man. Really appreciate it. What is a last send-off takeaway message you'd like to leave the Elite Man audience, and then a place that our listeners can check out more about you?
You know, I think it's just, if I could leave any message, would be change is possible. Wherever you are, whatever's happening to you, you know, we all tend to think like, I'm this kind of person. I'm just this kind of person. I'm an addict, or I'm a person who's lazy, or I don't follow through. Change is a skill. You can learn it. And so, you know, you can change. Just keep believing in yourself and keep trying. And then as far as where to find me, the podcast is at oneyoufeed.net, and you can find links to everything there. And then also the coaching program is ericzimmer.coach, and you can find more about the program. I've got a long, like 40-minute video out there where I lay out a lot of these principles, and you can get that information there.
Cool, man. Love it. Eric, thanks again for coming on, man. Really appreciate it. I know our guys are going to love this one. So take care, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks so much, Justin. It's been a pleasure.
And just one more reminder, guys, before you go, make sure you check out our YouTube channel and subscribe to our channel right now. Go to elitemanmagazine.com/YouTube or click the link in the show notes.
All right, guys, I hope you enjoyed that episode. But before you go, there's one last thing I need you to do. I need you to subscribe to this podcast right now if you haven't already. By subscribing to the podcast, you get every single episode the minute they're released. Get all of our Elite Man podcast interviews with all of our incredible world-class guests from the lifestyle, health, fitness, business, and social worlds absolutely free. Subscribe now, guys, if you haven't already, and enjoy all future episodes. And yes, if you do love the podcast, leave us an awesome review. We really do appreciate it.